no longer put off facing what had to be faced. He had gone down to the store 24 at the bottom of the hill and bought his first pack of cigarettes in 11 years. He had gone back to his old brand like a murderer returning to the scene of his crime. In hoc signo vinces was what it said on each blood-red pack. In this sign shalt thou conquer, according to his old man, who had conquered Daniels's mother in a lot of kitchen brawls, but not much else, so far as Norman had ever seen. The initial drag had made him feel dizzy, and by the time he'd finished the first cigarette, smoking it all the way down to a roach, he'd been sure he was going to puke, faint, or have a heart attack, maybe all three at once. But now here he was, back up to two packs a day, and hacking out that same old way down in the bottom of your lungs cough when he rolled out of bed in the morning. It was like he'd never been away. That was all right, though. He was going through a stressful life experience, as the psychology pukes like to say, and when people went through stressful life experiences, they often went back to their old habits. Habits, especially bad ones like smoking and drinking, were crutches, people said. So what? If you had a limp, what was wrong with using a crutch? Once he'd taken care of Rosie, made sure that if there was going to be an informal divorce, it would be on his own terms, you might say, he would throw all his crutches away. This time, for good. Norman turned his head and looked out the window. Not dark yet, but getting there. Close enough to get going, anyway. He didn't want to be late for his appointment. He mashed out his cigarette in the overflowing ashtray on the night table beside the telephone, swung his feet off the bed, and began to dress. There was no hurry. That was the nicest thing. He'd had all those accumulated off days coming, and Captain Hardaway hadn't been the slightest bit chintzy about giving them to him when he asked. There were two reasons for that, Norman reckoned. First, the newspapers and TV stations had made him the flavor of the month. Second, Captain Hardaway didn't like him, had twice sicked the IA shoe flies on him because of excessive force allegations, and had undoubtedly been glad to get rid of him for a while. Tonight, bitch. Norman murmured as he rode down in the elevator, alone except for his reflection in the tired old mirror at the back of the car. Tonight, if I get lucky, and I feel lucky. There was a line of cabs drawn up at the curb, but Daniels bypassed them. Cab drivers kept records, and sometimes they remembered faces. No, he would ride the bus again, a city bus this time. He walked briskly toward the bus stop on the corner, wondering if he had been kidding himself about feeling lucky, and deciding he had not been. He was close. He knew it. He knew it because he had found his way back into her head. The bus, one that ran the Green Line route, came around the corner and rolled up to where Norman was standing. He got on, paid his four bits, sat in back. He didn't have to be Rose tonight, what a relief, and looked out the window as the streets rolled by. Bar signs, restaurant signs, deli, beer, pizza by the slice, sexy topless girls. You don't belong here, Rose, he thought as the bus went past the window of a restaurant named Pop's Kitchen, strictly Kansas City beef, said the blood-red neon sign in the window. You don't belong here, but that's all right, because I'm here now. I've come to take you home. To take you somewhere, anyway. The tangles of neon and the darkening velvet sky made him think of the good old days when life hadn't seemed so weird and somehow claustrophobic, like the walls of a room that keeps getting smaller, slowly closing in on you. When the neon came on, the fun started. That was how it had been, anyway, back then in the relatively uncomplicated years of his 20s. You found a place where the neon was bright and you slipped in. Those days were gone, but most cops, most good cops, remembered how to slip around after dark, how to slip around behind the neon, and how to ride the street grease. A cop who couldn't do those things didn't last very long. He had been watching the signs march past and judged that he should be approaching Carolina Street now. He got to his feet, walked to the front of the bus, and stood there holding the pole. When the bus pulled up at the corner and the doors flapped open, he walked down the steps and slipped into the darkness without saying a word. He'd bought a city street map in the hotel newsstand, $6.50, outrageous, but the cost of asking directions could be even higher. People had a way of remembering the people who asked them directions. Sometimes they remembered even 5 years later, amazing but true, so it was better not to ask, in case something happened, something bad, Probably nothing would, but TCB and CYA were always the best rules to live by. According to his map, Carolina Street connected with Beaudry Place, about 4 blocks west of the bus stop. A nice little walk on a warm evening. Beaudry Place was where the Traveler's Aid Jew boy lived. Daniels walked slowly, really just sauntering, with his hands in his pockets. His expression was bemused and slightly dopey, giving no clue that all his senses were on yellow alert. He catalogued each passing car, each passing pedestrian, looking especially for anyone who appeared to be looking especially at him, to be seeing him. There was no one, and that was good. When he reached Thumper's house, and that's what it was, a house, not an apartment, another break, he walked past it twice, observing the car in the driveway and the light in the lower front window, living room window. The drapes were open, but the shears were drawn. Through them, he could see a soft, colored blur that had to be the television. Thumper was up. Thumper was home. Thumper was watching a little tube and maybe munching a carrot or two before heading down to the bus station, where he would try to help more women too stupid to deserve help, or too bad. Thumper hadn't been wearing a wedding ring, and had the look of a closet queer to Norman anyway, but better safe than sorry. He drifted up the driveway and peeked into Thumper's 4 or 5-year-old Ford, looking for anything that would suggest the man didn't live alone. He saw nothing that set off any warning bells. Satisfied, he looked up and down the residential street again and saw no one. "You don't have a mask," he thought. "You don't even have a nylon stocking you can pull over your face, Normie, do you?" No, he didn't. "You forgot, didn't you?" Well, actually, no, he hadn't. He had an idea that when the sun came up tomorrow, there was going to be one less urban Jew boy in the world, because sometimes bad stuff happened, even in nice residential neighborhoods like this. Sometimes people broke in, jigs and junkies for the most part, of course, and there went the old ball game. Tough but true, shit happens, as the t-shirts and bumper stickers said. And sometimes, hard as it was to believe, shit happened to the right people instead of the wrong ones. Prived of reading Jew boys who helped wives get away from husbands, for instance. You couldn't just put up with stuff like that. It was no way to run a society. If everyone acted like that, there wouldn't even be a society. It was pretty much rampant behavior, though, because most of the bleeding hearts got away with it. Most of the bleeding hearts hadn't made the mistake of helping his wife, however, and this man had. Norman knew that as well as he knew his own name. This man had helped her. He mounted the steps, took one more quick look around, and rang the doorbell. He waited, then rang again. Now his ears, already attuned to catch the slightest noise, picked up the sound of approaching feet, not clack, 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 but hish, hish, hish. Thumper in his stocking feet. How cozy. "Coming, coming," Thumper called. The door opened. Thumper looked out at him, big eyes swimming behind his horn-rimmed glasses. "Can I help you?" he asked. His outer shirt was unbuttoned and untucked, hanging over a strap-style t-shirt, the same style of t-shirt Norman himself wore, and suddenly it was too much. Suddenly it was the last straw, the one that fractured the old dromedary's spinal column, and he was insane with rage that a man like this should wear an undershirt like his, a white man's undershirt. "I think you can," Norman said, and something in his face or his voice, perhaps it was both, must have alarmed Slowick, because his brown eyes widened, and he started to draw back, his hand going to the door, probably meaning to slam it in Norman's face. If so, he was too late. Norman moved fast, seizing the sides of Slowick's outer shirt and driving him back into the house. Norman raised one foot and kicked the door shut behind him, feeling as graceful as Gene Kelly in an MGM musical. "Yeah, I think so," he said again. "I hope for your sake you can. I'm going to ask you some questions, Thumper. Good questions, and you better pray to your big-nosed Jew boy God that you're able to come up with some good answers." "Get out of here," Slowick cried, "or I'll call the police." Norman Daniels had a good chuckle at that, and then he whirled Slowick around, twisting Slowick's left fist up until it touched his scrawny right shoulder blade. Slowick began to scream. Norman reached between his legs and cupped his testicles. "Stop," he said. "Stop it right now, or I'll pop your balls like grapes. You'll hear them go." Thumper stopped. He was gasping and letting out an occasional choked whimper, but Norman could live with that. He herded Thumper back into the living room, where he used the remote control he found sitting on an end table to turn up the television. He frog-marched his new pal into the kitchen and let go of him. "Stand against the refrigerator," he said. "I want to see your ass and shoulder blades squashed right up against that baby, and if you move so much as an inch away from it, I'll rip your lips off. Got it?"
Yes, Thumper said.
Who are you?" He still looked like Bambi's friend Thumper, but now he was starting to sound like Woodsy fucking Owl. "Irving R. Levine, NBC News," Norman said. "This is how I spend my day off." He began pulling open the drawers along the counter, keeping an eye on Thumper as he did so. He didn't think old Thump was going to run, but he might. Once people got beyond a certain level of fright, they became as unpredictable as tornadoes.
"What? I don't know what."
"You don't have to know what," Norman said. "That's the beauty of this, Thump. You don't have to know a goddamn thing except the answers to a few very simple questions. Everything else can be left to me. I'm a professional. Think of me as one of the good hands people." He found what he was looking for in the fifth and last drawer down the line, two oven gloves with flower patterns. How cute. Just what the well-dressed Jew boy would want to wear when taking his Widow Kosher casseroles out of his Widow Kosher oven. Norman pulled them on, then went quickly back down the drawer pulls, rubbing out any prints he might have left. Then he marched Thumper back into the living room, where he picked up the remote control and wiped it briskly on the front of his shirt. "We're going to have us a little face-to-face here, Thumper," Norman said as he did this. His throat had thickened. The voice which came out of it sounded barely human, even to its owner. Norman wasn't very surprised to find he had a raging hard-on. He tossed the remote control onto the sofa and turned to Slowick, who was standing there with his shoulders slumped and tears oozing out from beneath his thick, horn-rimmed glasses, standing there in that white man's undershirt. "I'm going to talk to you up close. Right up close. Do you believe that? You better, Thump. You just fucking better."
"Please," Slowick moaned. He held his shaking hands out to Norman. "Please, don't hurt me. You've got the wrong man. Whoever you want, it's not me. I can't help you."
But in the end, Slowick helped quite a bit. By then, they were down cellar because Norman had begun to bite, and not even the TV turned all the way to top volume would have completely stifled the man's screams. But screams or no screams, he helped quite a bit. When the festivities were over, Norman found the garbage bags under the kitchen sink. Into one of these he put the oven gloves and his own shirt, which could not now be worn in public. He would take the bag with him and get rid of it later. Upstairs, in Thumper's bedroom, he found only one item of clothing that would come even close to covering his own much broader upper body, a baggy, faded Chicago Bulls sweatshirt. Norman laid this on the bed, then went into Thumper's bathroom and turned on Thumper's shower. While he waited for the water to run hot, he looked in Thumper's medicine cabinet, found a bottle of Advil, and took four. His teeth hurt and his jaws ached. The entire lower half of his face was covered with blood and hair and little tags of skin. He stepped into the shower and grabbed Thump's bar of Irish Spring, reminding himself to dump that into the bag, too. He actually didn't know how much good any of these precautions were going to be because he had no idea how much forensic evidence he might have left downstairs in the basement. He had kind of grayed out there for a while. As he washed his hair, he began to sing. He turned off the shower, stepped out, and looked at his own faint, ghostly image in the steamy mirror over the sink. "I can," he said flatly. "I can. That's who."
Bill Steiner was raising his free hand to knock yet again, mentally cursing his nervousness. He was a man who wasn't ordinarily nervous about women. When she answered, "Coming. I'm coming, just a second. Be right there." She didn't sound pissed, thank God, so maybe he hadn't rousted her out of the bathroom. "What in hell am I doing here anyway?" he asked himself again as the footsteps approached the door. "This is like a scene in some half-baked romantic comedy, kind of thing not even Tom Hanks can do much with." That might be true, but it didn't change the fact that the woman who had come into the shop last week had lodged firmly in his mind. And rather than fading as the days went by, her effect on him seemed to be cumulative. Two things were certain. This was the first time in his life he'd ever brought flowers to a woman he didn't know, and he hadn't felt this nervous about asking for a date since he'd been 16 years old. As the footsteps reached the other side of the door, Bill saw that one of the big daisies was on the verge of doing a header out of the bouquet. He made a hurried adjustment as the door opened, and when he looked up, he saw the woman who'd traded her fake diamond ring for a piece of bad art, standing there with murder in her eyes and a can of what looked like fruit cocktail raised over her head. She appeared frozen between her desire to make a preemptive strike and her mind's struggling realization that this wasn't the person she'd expected. It was, Bill thought later, one of the most exotic moments of his life. The two of them stood looking at each other across the door jamb of Rosie's second-floor room on Tremont Street. He with his bouquet of spring flowers from the shop two doors down on Hitchens Avenue. She with her 2-pound can of fruit cocktail raised over her head. And although the pause could not have lasted more than 2 or 3 seconds, it seemed very long to him. It was certainly long enough for him to realize something that was distressing, dismaying, annoying, amazing, and rather wonderful. Seeing her did not change things as he had rather expected it would. It made them worse instead. She wasn't beautiful, not the media version of beauty anyhow, but she was beautiful to him. The look of her lips and the line of her jaw, for some reason, just about stopped his heart. And the cat-like tilt of her bluish-gray eyes made him feel weak. His blood felt too high and his cheeks too hot. He knew perfectly well what these feelings signaled, and he resented them even as they made him captive. He held out the flowers to her, smiling hopefully but keeping tabs on the upraised can. "Truce?" he said. His invitation to go out to dinner with him followed so quickly on her realization that he wasn't Norman that she was surprised into accepting. She supposed simple relief played a part, too. It wasn't until she was in the passenger seat of his car that practical, sensible, who had been pretty much left in the dust, caught up and asked her what she was doing, going out with a man, a much younger man, she didn't know. Was she insane? There was real terror in these questions, but Rosie recognized the questions themselves for what they were, mere camouflage. The important question was so horrifying Practical Sensible didn't dare ask it, even from her place inside Rosie's head. What if Norman catches you? That was the important question. What if Norman caught her eating dinner with another man, a younger, good-looking man? The fact that Norman was 800 miles east of here didn't matter to Practical Sensible, who really wasn't practical and sensible at all, but only frightened and confused. Norman wasn't the only issue, however. She hadn't been alone with any man but her husband in her entire life as a woman, and right now her emotions were a gorgeous stew. Eat dinner with him? Oh, sure, right. Her throat had narrowed down to a pinhole, and her stomach was sudsing like a washing machine. If he had been wearing anything dressier than clean, faded jeans and an Oxford shirt, or if he'd given the faintest look of doubt to her own unpretentious skirt and sweater combination, she would have said no. And if the place he took her to had looked too difficult, it was the only word she could think of, she didn't believe she would have been able even to get out of his Buick. But the restaurant looked welcoming rather than threatening. A brightly lighted storefront called Pop's Kitchen, with paddle fans overhead and red and white checked tablecloths spread across butcher block tables. According to the neon sign in the window, Pop's Kitchen served strictly Kansas City beef. The waiters were all older gentlemen who wore black shoes and long aprons tied up under their armpits. To Rosie, they looked like white dresses with empire waists. The people eating at the tables looked like her and Bill. Well, like Bill, anyway. Middle class, middle-income folks wearing informal clothes. To Rosie, the restaurant felt cheerful and open, the kind of place where you could breathe. Maybe, but they don't look like you, Hermione whispered, and don't you go thinking that they do, Rosie. They look confident, they look happy, and most of all, they look like they belong here. You don't, and you never will. There were too many years with Norman, too many times when you sat in the corner vomiting into your apron. You've forgotten how people are and what they talk about, if you ever knew to begin with. If you try to be like these people, if you even dream you can be like these people, you are going to earn yourself a broken heart. Was that true? It was terrifying to think it might be, because part of her was happy. Happy that Bill Steiner had come to see her, happy that he had brought flowers, happy that he had asked her to dinner. She didn't have the slightest idea how she felt about him, but that she had been asked out on a date. That made her feel young and full of magic. She couldn't help it. Go on, feel happy, Norman said. He whispered the words into her ear as she and Bill stepped through the door of Pop's kitchen, words so close and so real that it was almost as if he were passing by. Enjoy it while you can, because later on he's going to take you back out into the dark, and then he's going to want to talk to you up close. Or maybe he won't bother with the talking part. Maybe he'll just drag you into the nearest alley and do you against the wall. No, she thought. Suddenly the bright lights inside the restaurant were too bright, and she could hear everything, everything, even the big, sloppy gasps of the overhead paddle fans walloping the air. No, that's a lie. He's nice, and that's a lie. The answer was immediate and inexorable, the gospel according to Norman. No one's nice, sweetheart. How many times have I told you that? Down deep, everyone's street grease. You, me, everyone. Rose, Bill asked. You okay? You look pale. No, she wasn't okay. She knew the voice in her head was a lying voice, one which came from a part of her that was still blighted by Norman's poison. But what she knew and what she felt were very different things. She couldn't sit in the midst of all these people, that was all, smelling their soaps and colognes and shampoos, listening to the bright interweavings of their chatter. She couldn't deal with the waiter who had come bending into her space with a list of specials, some perhaps in a foreign language. Most of all, she couldn't deal with Bill Steiner, talking to him, answering his questions, and all the time wondering how his hair would feel under her palm. She opened her mouth to tell him she wasn't okay, that she felt sick to her stomach, and he'd better take her home, perhaps another time. Then, as she had in the recording studio, she thought of the woman in the rose madder chiton, standing there on top of the overgrown hill, with her hand upraised and one bare shoulder gleaming in the strange, cloudy light of that place. Standing there completely unafraid, above a ruined temple that looked more haunted than any house Rosie had ever seen in her life. As she visualized the blonde hair in its plait, the gold armlet, and the barely glimpsed upswell of breast, the flutters in Rosie's stomach quieted. I can get through this, she thought. I don't know if I can actually eat, but surely I can find enough courage to sit down with him for a while in this well-lighted place. And am I going to worry about him raping me later on? I think rape is the last thing on this man's mind. That's just one of Norman's ideas. Norman, who believes no black man ever owned a portable radio that wasn't stolen from a white man. The simple truth of this made her sag a little with relief, and she smiled at Bill. It was weak and a little trembly at the corners, but better than no smile at all. I'm all right, she said. A tiny bit scared, that's all. You'll have to bear with me. Not scared of me. Damn right scared of you, Norman said from the place in her head where he lived like a vicious tumor. No, not exactly. She raised her eyes to his face. It was an effort, and she could feel her cheeks flushing, but she managed. It's just that you're only the second guy I've ever gone out with in my whole life. And if this is a date, it's the first real one I've been on since my high school senior prom. That was back in 1980. Holy God, he said. He spoke softly and without a trace of facetiousness. Now I'm getting a little scared. The host, Rosie wasn't sure if you called him a maitre d' or if that was someone else, came up and asked if they wanted smoking or non-smoking. Do you smoke? Bill asked her, and Rosie quickly shook her head. Somewhere out of the mainstream would be great, Bill said to the man in the tuxedo, and Rosie caught a gray-green flicker, she thought it was a $5 bill, passing from Bill's hand to the host's. A corner, maybe. Certainly, sir. He led them through the brightly lighted room and beneath the lazily turning paddle fans. When they receded, Rosie asked Bill how he had found her, although she supposed she already knew. What she was really curious about was why he had found her. It was Robbie Lefferts, he said. Robbie comes in every few days to see if I've gotten any new paperbacks. Well, old paperbacks, actually. You know what I mean. She remembered David Goodis. It was a tough break. Perry was innocent, and smiled. I knew he hired you to read the Christina Bell novels because he came in special to tell me. He was very excited. Was he really? He said you were the best voice he'd heard since Kathy Bates' recording of Silence of the Lambs, and that means a lot. Robbie worships that recording, along with Robert Frost reading The Death of the Hired Man. He's got that on an old 33 1/3 Cadman LP. It's scratchy, but it's amazing. Rosie was silent. She felt overwhelmed. So I asked him for your address. Well, that's maybe a little too glossy. The ugly truth is I pestered him into it. Robbie's one of those people who happen to be very vulnerable to pestering, and to do him full credit, Rosie. But the rest drifted away from her. Rosie, she was thinking. He called me Rosie. I didn't ask him to, he just did it. Would either of you folks care for a drink? A waiter had appeared at Bill's elbow. Elderly, dignified, handsome, he looked like a college literature professor. One with a penchant for empire waist dresses, Rosie thought, and felt like giggling. I'd like iced tea, Bill said. How about you, Rosie? And again. He did it again. How does he know I was never really a rose, that I've always been really Rosie? That sounds fine. Two iced teas? Excellent, the waiter said, and then recited a short list of specials. To Rosie's relief, all were in English. And at the words London broil, she actually felt a thin thread of hunger. We'll think it over. Tell you in a minute, Bill said. The waiter left, and Bill turned back to Rosie. Two other things in Robbie's favor, he said. He suggested I stop by the studio. You're in the Corn Building, aren't you? Yes, Tape Engine is the name of the studio. Uh-huh. Anyway, he suggested I stop by the studio, that all three of us could maybe go out for a drink after rap one afternoon. Very protective, almost fatherly. When I told him I couldn't do that, he made me absolutely promise that I'd call you first. And I tried, Rosie, but I couldn't get your number from directory assistance. Are you unlisted? I don't actually have a phone yet, she said, sidestepping a little. She was unlisted, of course. It had cost an extra $30, money she could ill afford. But she could afford even less to have her number pop up on a police computer back home. She knew from Norman's bitching that the police couldn't conduct random sweeps of unlisted phone numbers the way they could sweep the ones in the phone books. It was illegal, an invasion of the privacy people voluntarily gave up when they allowed the phone company to list their numbers. So the courts had ruled, and like most of the cops she met during the course of her marriage, Norman had a virulent hatred for all courts and all their works. Why couldn't you come by the studio? Were you out of town? He picked up his napkin, unfolded it, and put it carefully down on his lap. When he looked up again, she saw his face had changed somehow, but it took several moments more for her to grasp the obvious. He was blushing. Well, I guess I didn't want to go out with you in a gang, he said. You don't really get to talk to a person that way. I just sort of wanted to, well, get to know you. And here we are, she said softly. Yes, that's right, here we are. But why did you want to get to know me, to go out with me? She paused for a moment, then said the rest. I mean, I'm sort of old for you, aren't I? He looked incredulous for a moment, then decided it was a joke and laughed. Yeah, he said. How old are you anyway, Granny? 27? 28? At first she thought he was making a joke, not a very good one either, and then realized he was serious enough underneath the light tone, not even trying to flatter her, only stating the obvious. What was obvious to him, anyway. The realization shocked her, and her thoughts went flying in all directions again. Only one came through with any sort of clarity. The changes in her life had not ended with finding a job and a place of her own to live. They had only begun. It was as if everything that had happened up to this point had just been a series of pre-shocks, and this was the onset of the actual quake. Not an earthquake, but a life quake. And suddenly she was hungry for it, and excited in a way she did not understand. Bill started to speak, and then the waiter came with their iced teas. Bill ordered a steak, and Rosie asked for the London broil. When the waiter asked her how she wanted it, she started to say medium well. That was how she ate beef, because that was how Norman ate beef. And then she took it back. Rare, she said. Very. Excellent, the waiter said, speaking as if he really meant it, and as he walked away, Rosie thought what a wonderful place a waiter's utopia would be, a place where every choice was excellent, very good, marvelous. When she looked back at Bill, she saw his eyes still on her, those disquieting eyes with their dim green undertint. Sexy eyes. How bad was it? He asked her. Your marriage? What do you mean? She asked awkwardly. You know what? I meet this woman in my dad's swap and loan. I talk to her for maybe 10 minutes. And then the goddamnedest thing happens to me. I can't forget her. This is something I've seen in the movies, occasionally read about in the kind of magazines you always find in the doctor's waiting room. But I never really believed it. Now, boom, here it is. I see her face in the dark when I turn out the light. I think about her when I eat my lunch. He paused, giving her a considering, worried look. I hope I'm not scaring you. He was scaring her a lot. But at the same time, she thought she had never heard anything so wonderful. She was hot all over except for her feet, which were cold as ice, and she could still hear the fans churning the air overhead. There seemed to be 1,000 of them at least, a battalion of fans. This lady comes in to sell me her engagement ring, which she thinks is a diamond, except way down deep where she knows better. Then when I find out where she lives and go to see her, with a bouquet in my hand and my heart in my mouth, you might say, she comes this far from braining me with a can of fruit cocktail. He held up his right hand with a thumb and forefinger 1/2 inch apart. Rosie held her own hand up, the left, with a thumb and forefinger 1 inch apart. Actually, it was more like this, she said. And I'm like Roger Clemens. I have excellent control. He laughed hard at that. It was a good sound, honest and from the belly. After a moment, she joined him. In any case, the lady doesn't exactly fire the missile, just makes this scary little downward twitch with it, then hides it behind her back like a kid with the copy of Playboy he stole out of his dad's bureau drawer. She says, "Oh, my God, I'm sorry. And I wonder who the enemy is, since it's not me." And then I wonder how X the husband can be when the lady came into my dad's pawn shop with her ring still on. You know? Yes, she said. I suppose I do. It's important to me. If it seems like I'm being nosy, okay, probably I am, but on very short notice, I'm very taken with this woman, and I don't want her to be very attached. On the other hand, I don't want her to be so scared she has to go to the door with a jumbo-sized can of fruit cocktail in her hand every time someone knocks. Is any of this making any sense to you? Yes, she said. The husband is pretty X. And then for no reason at all, she added, his name's Norman. Bill nodded solemnly. I see why you left him. Rosie began to giggle and clapped her hands to her mouth. Her face felt hotter than ever. At last she got it under control, but by then she had to wipe her eyes with the corner of her napkin. Okay, he asked. Yes, I think so. Want to tell me about it? An image suddenly arose in her mind, one with all the clarity of something seen in a vivid nightmare. It was Norman's old tennis racket, the prince with the black tape wound round the handle. It was still hanging by the foot of the cellar stairs back home, as far as she knew. He had spanked her with it several times during the first years of their marriage. Then, about 6 months after her miscarriage, he had anally raped her with it. She had shared a lot of things about her marriage. That was what they called it, sharing, a word she found simultaneously hideous and apt, in therapy circle at DNS. But that was one little nugget she'd kept to herself. How it felt to have the taped handle of a prince tennis racket jammed up your ass by a man who sat straddling you, with his knees on the outsides of your thighs. How it felt to have him lean over and tell you that if you fought, he would break the water glass on the table beside the bed and cut your throat with it. How it felt to lie there, smelling the dentine on his breath, and wondering how bad he was ripping you up. "No," she said, and was grateful that her voice didn't tremble. "I don't want to talk about Norman. He was abusive and I left him. End of story." "Fair enough," Bill said. "And he's out of your life for good." "For good." "Does he know that? I only asked because of, you know, the way you came to the door. You sure weren't expecting a representative from the Church of Latter-day Saints." "I don't know if he knows it or not," she said, after a moment or two to think it over. "Certainly, it was a fair enough question." "Are you afraid of him?" "Oh, yes, you bet. But that doesn't necessarily mean a lot. I'm afraid of everything. It's all new to me. My friends say I'll grow out of it, but I don't know." "You weren't afraid to come out to dinner with me?" "Oh, yes, I was. I was terrified." "Why did you, then?" She opened her mouth to say what she had been thinking earlier, that he had surprised her into it, and then closed it again. That was the truth, but it wasn't the truth inside the truth, and this was an area where she didn't want to do any sidestepping. She had no idea if the two of them had any sort of future beyond this one meal in Pop's kitchen, but if they did, fancy footwork would be a bad way to begin the trip. "Because I wanted to," she said. Her voice was low but clear. "All right, no more about that. And no more about Norman, either." "That's his for real, no fooling name?" "Yes." "As in Bates?" "As in Bates." "Can I ask you about something else, Rosie?" She smiled a little. "As long as I don't have to promise to answer." "Fair enough." "You thought you were older than me, didn't you?" "Yes," she said. "Yes, I did." "How old are you, Bill?" 30, which has got to make us something like next-door neighbors in the age sweepstakes. Same street, anyway. But you made an almost automatic assumption that you weren't just older, you were a lot older. "So, here comes the question. Are you ready?" Rosie shrugged uneasily. He leaned toward her, those eyes with their fascinating greenish undertint fixed on hers. "Do you know you're beautiful?" he asked. "That's not a come-on or a line. It's plain old curiosity. Do you know you're beautiful?" "You don't, do you?" She opened her mouth. Nothing emerged but one tiny breath noise from the back of her throat. It was closer to a whistle than a sigh. He put his hand over hers and squeezed it, gently. His touch was brief, but it still lit up her nerves like an electric shock, and for a moment he was the only thing she could see. His hair, his mouth, and most of all, his eyes. The rest of the world was gone, as if the two of them were on a stage where all the lights except for one bright, burning spot had been turned out. "Don't make fun of me," she said. Her voice trembled. "Please don't make fun. I can't stand it if you do." "No, I'd never do that." He spoke absently, as if this were a subject beyond discussion, case closed. "But I'll tell you what I see." He smiled and stretched out his hand to touch hers again. "I'll always tell you what I see. That's a promise." She said he needn't bother escorting her up the stairs, but he insisted, and she was glad. Their conversation had passed on to less personal things when their meals came. He was delighted to find out the Roger Clemens reference hadn't been a fluke, that she had a knowledgeable fan's understanding of baseball, and they had talked a lot about the city's teams as they ate, passing naturally enough from baseball to basketball. She'd hardly thought of Norman at all until the ride back, when she began imagining how she would feel if she opened the door of her room and there he was, Norman, sitting on her bed, drinking a cup of coffee, maybe, and contemplating her picture of the ruined temple and the woman on the hill. Then, as they mounted the narrow stairs, Rosie in the lead and Bill a step or two behind, she found something else to worry about. What if he wanted to kiss her goodnight? And what if, after a kiss, he asked if he could come in? "Of course he'll want to come in," Norman told her, speaking in the heavily patient voice he employed when he was trying not to be angry with her, but was getting angry anyway. "In fact, he'll insist on it. Why else would he spring for a $50 meal? Jesus, you ought to be flattered. There are gals on the street prettier than you who don't get 50 for half and half. He'll want to come in, and he'll want to fuck you, and maybe that's good. Maybe that's what you need to get your head out of the clouds." She was able to get her key out of her bag without dropping it, but the tip chattered all the way around the slot in the center of the metal disc without going in. He closed his hand over hers and guided it home. She felt that electric shock again when he touched her, and was helpless not to think of what the key sliding into the lock called to her mind. She opened the door. No Norman, unless he was hiding in the shower or the closet. Just her pleasant room with the cream-colored walls and the picture hanging by the window and the light on over the sink. Not home, not yet, but a little closer than the dorm at D&S. "This is not bad, you know," he said thoughtfully. "No duplex in the suburbs, but not at all bad." "Would you like to come in?" she asked through lips that felt completely numb. It was as if someone had slipped her a shot of Novocaine. "I could give you a cup of coffee." "Good," Norman exulted from his stronghold inside her head. "Might as well get it over with, right, hon? You give him the coffee, and he'll give you the cream. Such a deal." Bill appeared to think it over very carefully before shaking his head. "It might not be such a good idea," he said. "Not tonight, at least. I don't think you have the slightest idea of how you affect me." He laughed a little nervously. "I don't think I have the slightest idea of how you affect me." He looked over her shoulder and saw something that made him smile and offer her a pair of thumbs up. "You were right about the picture. I never would have believed it at the time, but you were. I guess you must have had this place in mind, though, huh?" She shook her head, now smiling herself. "When I bought the picture, I didn't even know this room existed." "You must be psychic, then. I bet it looks especially good there where you've hung it in the late afternoon and early evening. The sun must sidelight it."
"Yes, it's nice then," Rosie said, not adding that she thought the picture looked good, perfectly right and perfectly in place, at all times of the day.
"You're not bored with it yet, I take it."
"No, not at all."
She thought of adding,
"And it's got some very funny tricks. Step over and take a closer look, why don't you? Maybe you'll see something even more surprising than a lady getting ready to brain you with a can of fruit cocktail. You tell me, Bill, has that picture somehow gone from ordinary screen size to Cinerama 70, or is that just my imagination?"
She said none of this, of course. Bill put his hands on her shoulders, and she looked up at him solemnly, like a child being put to bed. As he leaned forward and kissed her forehead on the smooth place between her eyebrows.
"Thank you for coming out with me," he said. "Thank you for asking." She felt a tear go sliding down her left cheek and wiped it away with her knuckle. She was not ashamed or afraid for him to see it. She felt she could trust him with at least one tear, and that was nice.
"Listen," he said. "I've got a motorcycle, an old Butch Harley Softail. It's big and loud, and sometimes it stalls at long red lights, but it's comfortable,
And I'm a remarkably safe cyclist, if I do say so myself. One of the 6 Harley owners in America who wears a helmet. If Saturday's nice, I could come over and pick you up in the morning. There's a place I know about 30 miles up the lake. Beautiful. It's still too cold to swim, but we could bring a picnic. At first, she was incapable of any sort of answer. She was simply flattened by the fact that he was asking her out again. And then there was the idea of riding on his motorcycle. How would that be? For a moment, all Rosie could think of was how it might feel to be behind him on 2 wheels, cutting through space at 50 or 60 miles an hour, to have her arms around him. A totally unexpected heat rushed through her, something like a fever, and she did not recognize it for what it was, although she thought she remembered feeling something like it a very long time ago. Rosie, what do you say? Well, what did she say? Rosie touched her tongue nervously to her upper lip, glanced away from him in an effort to clear her mind, and saw the pile of yellow flyers sitting on the counter. She felt both disappointment and relief as she looked back at Bill. I can't. Saturday's the daughters and sisters picnic. Those are the people who helped me when I came here, my friends. There's a softball game, races, horseshoes, craft booths, things like that, and then a concert that night, which is supposed to be the real moneymaker. This year we're having the Indigo Girls. I promised I'd work the T-shirt concession from 5 o'clock on, and I ought to do it. I owe them such a lot. I could have you back by 5, no sweat, he said. 4, if you wanted. She did want to, but she had a lot more to be afraid of than just showing up late to sell T-shirts. Would he understand that if she told him? If she said, I'd love to put my arms around you while you drive fast, and I'd love for you to wear a leather jacket so I could put my face against the shoulders and smell that good smell and hear the little creaking sounds it makes when you move. I'd love that. But I think I'm afraid of what I might find out later on, when the ride was over, that the Norman inside my head was right all along about the things you really want. What scares me the most is having to investigate the most basic premise of my husband's life, the one thing he never said out loud because he never had to. That the way he treated me was perfectly okay, perfectly normal. It's not pain I'm afraid of. I know about pain. What I'm afraid of is the end of this small, sweet dream. I've had so few of them, you see. She realized what she needed to say, and realized in the next moment that she couldn't say it, perhaps because she'd heard it in so many movies, where it always came out sounding like a whine. Don't hurt me. That was what she needed to say. Please, don't hurt me. The best part of me that's left will die if you hurt me. But he was still waiting for her answer, waiting for her to say something. Rose opened her mouth to say no, she really ought to be there for the picnic as well as the concert, maybe another time. Then she looked at the picture hanging on the wall beside the window. She wouldn't hesitate, Rosie thought. She would count the hours until Saturday, and when she was finally mounted behind him on that iron horse, she would spend most of the ride thumping him on the back and urging him to make it gallop faster. For a moment, Rosie could almost see her sitting there, the hem of her rose madder chiton hiked high, her bare thighs firmly clasping his hips. That hot flash swept through her again, stronger this time, sweeter. Okay, she said. I'll do it, on one condition. Name it, he said. He was grinning, obviously delighted. Bring me back to Ettinger's Pier, that's where the DNS thing is happening, and stay for the concert. I'll buy the tickets. It's my treat. Deal, he said instantly. Can I pick you up at 8:30, or is that too early? No, it's fine. You'll want to wear a coat, maybe a sweater, too, he said. You might be able to stow them in the saddlebags coming back in the afternoon, but going out's going to be chilly. All right, she said, already thinking that she would have to borrow those items from Pam Haverford, who was about the same size. Rosie's entire outerwear wardrobe at this point consisted of one light jacket,
and the budget wouldn't stand any further purchases in that department, at least for a while. I'll see you then. And thanks again for tonight. He seemed briefly to consider kissing her again, then simply took her hand and squeezed it for a moment. You're welcome. He turned and ran quickly down the stairs, like a boy. She couldn't help contrasting this to Norman's way of moving, either at a head-down plod or with a kind of spooky, darting speed. She watched his elongated shadow on the wall until it disappeared. Then she closed the door, secured both locks, and leaned against it, looking across the room at her picture. It had changed again. She was almost sure of it. Rosie walked across the room and stood in front of it, with her hands clasped behind her back, and her head thrust slightly forward, the position making her look comically like a New Yorker caricature of an art gallery patron or a museum habitué. Yes, she saw, although the picture's dimensions remained the same, she was all but positive that it had widened again somehow. On the right, beyond the second stone face, the one peering blindly sideways through the tall grass, she could now see what looked like the beginnings of a forest glade. On the left, beyond the woman on the hill, she could now see the head and shoulders of a small, shaggy pony. It was wearing blinders, was cropping at the high grass, and appeared to be harnessed to some sort of a rig, perhaps a cart, perhaps a shay or a surrey. That part Rosie couldn't see. It was out of the picture, so far, at least. She could see some of its shadow, however, and another shadow as well growing out of it. She thought this second shadow was probably the head and shoulders of a person, someone standing beside the vehicle to which the pony was harnessed, maybe. Or maybe you've gone out of your mind, Rosie. You don't really think this picture is getting bigger, do you? Or showing more stuff, if you like that better? But the truth was, she did believe that. She saw that. And she found herself more excited than scared by the idea. She wished she had asked Bill for his opinion. She would have liked to know if he saw anything like what she was seeing, or thought she was seeing. Saturday, she promised herself. Maybe I'll do it Saturday. She began to undress, and by the time she was in the tiny bathroom brushing her teeth, she had forgotten all about Rose Matter, the woman on the hill. She had forgotten all about Norman, too, and Anna and Pam and the Indigo Girls on Saturday night. She was thinking about her dinner with Bill Steiner, replaying her date with him minute by minute, second by second. She lay in bed, slipping toward sleep, listening to the sound of crickets coming from Bryant Park. As she drifted, she found herself remembering, without pain and seemingly from a great distance, the year 1985 and her daughter Caroline. As far as Norman was concerned, there had never been a Caroline, and the fact that he had agreed with Rosie's hesitant suggestion that Caroline was a nice name for a girl didn't change that. To Norman, there had been only a tadpole that ended early. If it happened to be a girl tadpole, according to some nutty head trip his wife was on, so what? 800 million red Chinese didn't give a shit, in Norman's speak. 1985. What a year that had been. What a year from hell. She had lost Caroline, the baby. Norman had nearly lost his job, had come close to being arrested, she had an idea. She had gone to the hospital with a broken rib that had lacerated and almost punctured her lung, and, as a small extra added attraction, she had been cornholed with the handle of a tennis racket. That was also the year her mind, remarkably stable until then, began to slip a little. But in the midst of all those other festivities, she barely noticed that half an hour in Pooh's chair sometimes felt like 5 minutes, and that there were days when she took 8 or 9 showers between the time Norman left for work and the time he came back home. She must have caught pregnant in January, because that was when she started to be sick in the mornings, and she missed her first period in February. The case which prompted Norman's official reprimand, one that would be carried in his jacket until the day he retired, had come in March. What was his name?
she asked herself, still drifting in her bed, somewhere between sleep and waking, but for the time being still closer to the latter. The man who started all the trouble, what was his name? For a moment, it wouldn't come. Only the memory that he had been a black man, a jiggity-jig, in Norman speak. Then she got it. Bender, she murmured in the dark, listening to the low creak of the crickets. Richie Bender, that was his name. 1985, a hell of a year. A hell of a life. And now there was this life. This room, this bed, and the sound of crickets. Rosie closed her eyes and drifted.
Less than 3 miles from his wife now, Norman lay in his own bed, slipping towards sleep, slipping into darkness and listening to the steady rumble of traffic on Lakefront Avenue, 9 floors below him. His teeth and jaws still ached, but the pain was distant now, unimportant, hidden behind a mixture of aspirin and scotch. As he drifted, he also found himself thinking about Richie Bender. It was as if, unknown to either of them, Norman and Rosie had shared a brief telepathic kiss. Richie, he murmured into the shadows of his hotel room and then put his forearm over his closed eyes. Richie Bender, you puke. You fucking puke. A Saturday it had been, the first Saturday in March of 1985, 9 years ago, give or take. Around 11 a.m. on that day, a jiggity-jig had walked into the Payless store on the corner of 60th and Saranac, put 2 bullets in the clerk's head, looted the register, and walked out again. While Norman and his partner were questioning the clerk in the Bottle Redemption Center next door, they were approached by another jig, this one wearing a Buffalo Bills jersey. "I know that nigga," he said. "What nigger is that, bro?" Norman asked. "Nigger robbed that Payless," the jig had replied. "I was standing right over there by mailbox when he come out. Name Richie Bender. He a bad nigger. Sell crack out of his motel room down there." He had pointed vaguely east toward the train station. "What motel might that be?" Harley Bissington asked. Harley had been partnered with Norman on that unfortunate day. "Railroad Motel," the black man said. "I don't suppose you happen to know which room?" Harley had asked. "Does your knowledge of the purported miscreant stretch that far, my brown-skinned friend?" Harley had almost always talked that way. Sometimes it cracked Norman up. More often, it had made him want to grab the man by one of his narrow little knit ties and choke the Kokomo out of him. Their brown-skinned friend knew all right, of course he did. He was undoubtedly in there himself 2 or 3 times a week, maybe 5 or 6 if his current cash flow situation was good, buying rock from that bad nigger, Richie Bender, their brown-skinned friend and all his brown-skinned jiggity-jig pals. Probably this fellow currently had some sort of down on Richie Bender, but that was nothing to Norman and Harley. All Norman and Harley wanted was to know where the shooter was so they could bust his ass right over to county and clear this case before cocktail hour. The jig in the Bills jersey hadn't been able to recall the number of Bender's room, but he'd been able to tell them where it was just the same. First floor, main wing, right in between the Coke machine and the newspaper boxes. Norman and Harley had bopped on down to the Railroad Motel, clearly one of the city's finer dives, and knocked on the door between the Coke machine and the newspaper dispensers. The door had been opened by a slutty high yellow gal in a filmy red dress that lets you get a good look at her bra and panties, and she was obviously one stoned American, and the two cops could see what looked like 3 empty crack vials standing on top of the motel television, and when Norman asked her where Richie Bender was, she made the mistake of laughing at him. "I don't own no where in Blender," she said. "You go on now, boys, and get your honky asses out of here." All of that was pretty straightforward, but then the various accounts had gotten a little confusing. Norman and Harley said that Ms. Wendy Yarrow, known more familiarly in the Daniels kitchen that spring and summer as the slutty high yellow gal, had taken a nail file from her purse and slashed Norman Daniels with it twice. Certainly, he had long, shallow cuts across his forehead and the back of his right hand, but Ms. Yarrow claimed that Norman had made the cut across his hand himself and his partner had done the one over his eyebrows for him. They had done this, she said, after pushing her back into Unit 12 of the Railroad Motel, breaking her nose and 4 of her fingers, fracturing 9 bones in her left foot by stamping on it repeatedly, They took turns, she said, pulling out wads of her hair and punching her repeatedly.